Who are the real people we consider our sages? Who were they in life? What is the legacy they left us? Join Rabbi Danny Sackstein for the next hour as he explores the lives of our Torah giants, the spiritual geniuses who shaped the way we approach Judaism today. That's Focus on Our Sages right now on 101.9 Chai FM.
Good afternoon. Welcome to Soul to Soul. Always wonderful to be with you on a Wednesday afternoon. And today we're going to be looking at some very interesting things. We'll start out with the time in the calendar. The date today is the 18th day of the month of Tammuz in the Hebrew calendar, the 24th of July, 2024. Yesterday was the beginning of the 3 weeks, what we call the 3 weeks of mourning. It's a time, a significant time in our calendar where we remember the some hardships that took place for the Jewish people. This three-week period is bracketed with the fast of Shiva Avos Aser B'Tammuz, the 17th of Tammuz, which was yesterday, and it ends on Tisha B'Av, which is in 3 weeks' time, also a fast day, and it's the second most important fast apart from Yom Kippur, which is on the 13th of August, on Monday night and Tuesday, the 13th of August. And during and as the 3 weeks get further, so the customs of mourning intensify and get more severe. So now with the beginning yesterday of Shiva Aser B'Tammuz, so we've entered into the first phase of the 3 weeks. And from in the first phase, so the customs of mourning are that we don't listen to music and we don't cut hair and shave and we don't have weddings. And as we get closer to Tisha B'Av, so it intensifies, we have what's called the 9 days of mourning from Rosh Chodesh Av, which is coming up on Monday, the 5th of August. And then that starts the 9 days where the mourning gets more intense. And we'll discuss how more customs of mourning are observed from that time. And then the climax is Tisha B'Av, which is on the 13th of August. So this is yesterday's fast was commemorating a number of things that happened to the Jewish people. The first one, of course, was the Chet HaEgel, was the sin of the golden calf. The Jewish people bowed down to the calf and worshipped this golden calf. Much can be said about that, but it was a tremendous error that they made. They miscalculated when Moshe was due to come down. They thought he was supposed to come down the day before, which was the 40 days that he told them they'd be gone for. And they therefore panicked. And in the panic, they built this intermediary. They didn't replace Hashem, but rather was an intermediary for them to connect with Hashem. Without Moshe, they were frightened that they couldn't connect to Hashem directly. It was a tremendous error. And it's a very powerful point that as Jews, we don't need intermediaries. We all have a direct line to God, and we speak to God directly, which is a beautiful and powerful thing. And something that we should never forget. So on that day, the 17th of Tammuz, when the Jews were in the desert, that's when they built the calf. That's when the calf was broken and destroyed. And that's the beginning of a time of weakness for the Jewish people. The Achilles heel of the Jewish people is during this time, during these 3 weeks of mourning. Other things happened on that day as well. One of them being when the first temple was destroyed by Nebuchadnezzar. He had sieged the city. He hadn't yet destroyed the city, only destroyed the city on Tisha B'Av, but the animals for the Korban Tamid is a daily offering that was made in the Beis HaMikdash in the temple. So they ran out of animals to bring the Korban Tamid for the first time since the building of the first temple, which was almost 500 years before. They no longer were able to bring the Korban Tamid, which was a terrible thing. With regards to the destruction of the second temple, it's the day when the Romans breached the walls of the city. They only destroyed the temple 3 weeks later, but they breached the outer defenses of Yerushalayim on the 17th of Tammuz. So it was a sad day in our history, and it ushers in this period, which is, as mentioned, a weak time, a time when the Jewish people are vulnerable, a time when what we call our muzzle is not good. So we say, Mishin Nichnas Adam Marbim B'Simcha, when Adar comes, our joy increases. The mazel is good for the Jewish people. When Av comes, so we're heading towards the month of Av, when Av comes, mamatim b'simcha, we reduce our joy because it's a time of vulnerability, a time of not good mazel for the Jewish people. And we all daven for Mashiach that will be shifted, that will be changed, and we will see a positive mazel that will take place. So what I wanted to start out with today is an important message for the 3 weeks, and then we'll move on to something interesting, an interesting project that I would like to share with you. So in terms of material that I would like to talk about. So let's start out with one of the major lessons of the 3 weeks is the Jewish view of the world is a very internally focused view of our own spiritual growth. And I think that's very healthy and actually quite refreshing. Judaism tells us that what happens on the outside, in the outside world, to events that are occurring around us are a consequence of our inner choices. In other words, the work to be done is on the inside, is to improve ourselves, is to overcome our lower selves, is to restrain our urges for power and for pleasure, and to work. Once we do that spiritual work, so then that which we see out of ourselves will be harmonious with what's within us. In other words, our knee-jerk reaction to tragedy and to hardship and to calamity is inner work, which is really a wonderful way to view the world. And the Torah tells us the truth of how the world operates. So the way God runs the world is dependent on, it's a mirror image of the inner work we're doing. If we're not doing the inner work and we're giving into our lower selves and we're not connecting with God and spirituality, so that's going to be reflected in the darkness, in the emptiness, in the madness, in the volatility of the world around us. And when we are addressing those inner shortfalls and doing the inner work, so then that inner peace and balance will be reflected in the world around us. So it's an interesting view of the world, whereas the way the secular humanists view the world is that we have to go out and be activists and change the world. So we say, yes, we do have to change the world, but we change the world from within. The world, and that's much harder. It's much easier to go and protest on the streets and scream and shout about perceived injustices. But the real hard work is fixing ourselves up, is working on ourselves, is developing self-control and becoming noble human beings, not giving in to our Yetzirah, what we call our lower self, but rather developing ourselves in a manner where we rise above our physical urges. So that's the work of a Jew, and we emphasize that at this time of the 3 weeks, and the calamities and the suffering of the Jewish people are a consequence of us shirking our responsibilities in terms of doing our inner work, in terms of doing the spiritual work that we're supposed to be doing and that we committed to do when we entered into the covenant with God at Mount Sinai. And one of those areas is loving our fellow, is working on. So the Torah tells us one of the reasons why the second temple was destroyed was because of sinas chinam, because of senseless hatred. And when there's fraction, when there's what we call machlekas, when there's feribles within the Jewish people, so that undermines our spiritual iron dome, our protection from Hashem. And then we are vulnerable, and then we push God away, and that means that our enemies have the ability to harm us. That's how it works for the Jewish people. That's how those are the rules of engagement in the life of a Jew. And so it's a very important time that we address that issue and that we try to work on removing our resentment, our hatred, our the points of conflict with others. And it's much easier said than done. It's a very hard thing to do, especially if we feel like we were on the receiving end of injustice and when we feel like we have been mistreated by others. to be able to move past that and not to harbor the resentment in our hearts, but to let it go and forgive those people. Doesn't mean we have to be friends with those people, but it means we can't hate them in our heart. The Torah says, don't hate your fellow in your heart. Love your fellow as yourself. So our work at this time is letting go of the resentment and finding a way to see others in a positive light, to give others the benefit of the doubt. Very hard work indeed, but one of the important areas we need to be focusing on during these 3 weeks of mourning. Please stay with us. We'll be back in a moment.
This is Focus on Our Sages with Rabbi Danny Sackstein on 101.9 Chai FM.
Welcome back. And we are now discussing the work of the 3 weeks and loving our fellow like ourselves. And that's a very important thing that we need to do. So what we've been talking about is not harboring resentment, letting go of pain, of hurt, of feelings of rejection, and of being on the receiving end of what we perceive as unfair and incorrect behavior. So even though we feeling the pain of that and the hurt, somebody's hurt us, somebody's humiliated us, somebody who's treated us even in a cruel way, how is it that we can let that go, that we could move forward in a positive way, that we cannot keep the furibble going? You know, like sometimes these furibles just keep going. People don't even remember what the original incident was, but 15 years later, the furibles there, the split, the rift, the tension, the bitterness remains. So how do we move past that? And if we do that work, it does a tremendous amount in healing ourselves and our souls and healing the world, healing the Jewish world. For especially in times like these, when we're facing so much threat from the outside, that the Jewish people need to be one, we need to be united. And one of the ways that we merit divine protection, as I mentioned, is through that unity that the Jewish people need to develop and need to build within ourselves. So I was just in the bush last week, and always such a great privilege to be there in the magnificent African bush. And a thought came to mind, which perhaps will assist us in developing this ability to move on, to let go, not to hate our fellow in our heart, and to not live with bitterness and resentment. And that is seeing the backstory. So often when we are on the receiving end of what we perceive as cruel or harmful or vicious behavior from another, so we just view that incident and we look at their behavior and their treatment of us. But if we were able to train ourselves before we jump into the judgment, to try and see the bigger picture, to try and see the backstory of that person. Yes, they behaved in an incorrect and horrible way, but why are they behaving like this? What is their story? What are they going through? How do they see things in the world? And what's led them to choose to behave in this way? If we're able to do that, it makes it much easier for us to let it go and to move on. It's a famous vort of the Baal Shem Tov. The Baal Shem Tov says, you should love your fellow kamocha, like you love yourself. And the Baal Shem Tov explains to us that the way we see others is the way we should see ourselves. Love your fellow like yourself. How does a healthy person, a psychologically healthy person, view themselves? So they see that I have good points and I have bad points. I have strengths and I have weaknesses. But overall, I'm okay. I'm a good guy. I mean well. I want to do the right thing. That's how a healthy person views themselves, and that really is the foundation and source of a positive self-esteem. And so we need to see others in the same way. Kamocha, the way you see yourself and love yourself, you need to love others as well. That yes, this person has weaknesses, but they also have strengths. They have positive aspects to their character, and they have negative aspects to their character. But all in all, they're a good person. All in all, they mean well. All in all, when you see the bigger picture, so they want to do the right thing. Even if they didn't do the right thing to us, and even if they mistreated us, but nonetheless, when we open our perspective and broaden our horizons, we get a different perspective, and we will be able to then shift our focus from the pain, from the hurt, from being a victim to moving forward, to seeing a bigger perspective, to understanding their backstory, and to being able to let it go. So again, we don't have to be friendly with the person. We don't have to interact with the person, but we're not supposed to harbor resentment in our hearts towards them. Of course, you know, if people are cruel and if somebody is on the receiving end of abusive behavior, whether it's physical, emotional, one must bring that to an end immediately. And one is not required to be a victim and to be a doormat, for sure not. That's not what we're saying at all. What we are saying, however, is that one needs to try and let it go in our own hearts. Do what you need to do to protect yourself, but don't hold on to it and let it go. And then once we see the backstory of another, it's much easier for us to do so. And in the bush, there's an amazing illustration of this. So if one's fortunate enough to see, you know, obviously one of the best things to see in the bush is lions. And if one is fortunate enough to see a lion kill, so one observes an interesting thing. At a lion kill, the male lions help themselves first. The females are not happy with that, and they also want to help themselves, and especially because they usually have done the hunting. But the males won't let them near the kill. They'll attack them. If it's a big animal like a giraffe or a buffalo or even a wildebeest or zebra, so there's enough to go around. Maybe the lion will tolerate others eating at the same time. But if there's not enough to go around, the lion won't let any other member of the pride near the kill. So it seems bizarre, doesn't it? And it seems unfair. But when one understands the broader background of the lions and of their behavior and their life cycle, so one has a whole different perspective. So let's quickly mention that and discuss that. So a lion, usually a lion cub, when he's born, the lioness will leave the pride, give birth, and for about 6 weeks look after the cubs on her own. Very dangerous time for the lion cubs because she has to go out and hunt. And when she does, she leaves them unprotected, and they're vulnerable to hyenas, to leopards, even to buffalo will kill the lion cubs. And after 6 weeks, if they've survived, she'll introduce them to the pride. Still is a bit dangerous for them because the adolescents in the pride may be a little bit rough with them and may actually hurt them unless the mommy steps in. From the age of about 1 till 2.5, the lion cubs will have a much better time. Only about 1/3 of lions born make it to the age of 1. From 1 till 2.5, they integrate in the pride, they protect by the pride, they learn to hunt, they learn to socialize from the pride. From 2.5, there's a major difference between lions and lionesses. The male lions are now ready to mate. And the dominant males of the pride notice that and will not allow them to mate with the females of the pride and will send them or chase them out the pride. And these young males don't want to leave the pride, the protection and the security of the pride, but they after a while realize that if they don't leave, they'll be killed, that the dominant males will kill them. And so the more brothers they are, the more chance there is of them surviving. So these brothers are now thrown out the pride, and they enter into a nomadic stage where they go from one area to another, one territory of lions to another. And whenever they enter into a new lion's territory, they have to face the dominant males of their territory, and they're chased out. And they have to learn to hunt, and often they're not good hunters, they're inexperienced. They'll take an animal that's too big for them. They'll take a dangerous animal like a honey badger or porcupine and get hurt. And it's a very difficult time for them. From about the age of 4, so that's 2.5 till 4. From the age of 4, they've reached their prime, and they're ready to take on a dominant males of another pride. So they'll go to different territories, and those dominant males will come to chase them out. And if they're strong enough, they'll take them on. Sometimes they'll get hurt, or sometimes they'll win and they'll take over a pride, which is to see male lions fighting is a very brutal event to witness, because it really is it's frightening, and they're such powerful creatures and they fight to kill the other. So if they're fortunate enough, a male will then defeat another male and take over a pride. Only 1 in 8 male lions reach the stage and actually take over a pride of their own. As soon as they do so, they'll kill all the cubs of their pride, because they want to sire their own offspring and their offspring to be part of the pride. They'll mate with the females, and they will then become the dominant males, and they will have to protect their pride. And the dominant males of a pride, they roam the territory of the pride up to 20 kilometers a night to make sure that there are no intruders and to make sure the pride is safe, because when other young males want to take over, they'll kill their cubs. So in order for the cubs to be protected and in order for the pride to survive, it's necessary that the males of the pride are very strong and are healthy and are well fed. So because of their strength and size, they will take the kill first. But when you understand the background and the backstory, you see that it makes sense that they have to be strong and they have to be healthy and at their peak in order to protect the pride, in order to ensure that the cubs will survive and continue to live. So when we have that understanding of the backstory and we see now the male lions eating at the kill, we understand much better what the whole background is. And it doesn't seem to be as unfair and unjust as we originally thought, but we see that this is part of the survival of the whole pride. And so it's such a powerful lesson to us that before we run to judgment, when we look at others, we should understand there's a backstory. And with that backstory, it will explain so much to us, and that will give us the ability to give the person the benefit of the doubt and to let go of the bitterness, of the anger, of the resentment, to forgive them in our hearts and to fulfill one of the hardest mitzvahs in the whole Torah, of v'ahavta l'recha kamocha, of loving your fellow as yourself, of loving the person and not hating the person, of not having resentment. So they mirror images of each other, those two commandments, loving your fellow and lo sisna esachich bilvavecha, don't hate your fellow in your heart. So by seeing the broader picture and the backstory, it enables us, gives us a handle to give others the benefit of the doubt, to let it go, to not hate them in our heart, but rather to accept them and to love them. And that's a very big part of the work we should be doing now in the 3 weeks. So we all have our people that we don't get on with and that rub us up the wrong way and that we have conflict with. But if we can try and do that inner work, it will go very far in terms of healing the Jewish people and in terms of earning us the divine protection we desperately need at this vulnerable time in the world for Klal Yisrael. Okay, great. So now what I want to do, after we've introduced the 3 weeks and spoken a little bit about the work to be done and a beautiful illustration of this from the lions, from the bush, I want to discuss with you a book that Rabbi Beryl Wine has just written. Rabbi Wine wrote a wonderful new book that's just come out called 8 People We Met on the Way Home. And it discusses 8 individuals that played a major role in the Jews returning to the state of Israel and for us to have a state. And it really is fascinating. So maybe today we can go through one or two of those individuals, and then we can keep going. So it will be a little mini-series over here on Wednesday afternoons, and we'll get through all 8 of these fascinating individuals. The story of the Jewish people returning to Israel, the Jewish people always were in Israel. That's a very important fact that everybody needs to know. The historical revisionists who want to distort history want to say that it's a Palestinian land, the Palestinians were always there, and the Jews stole the land and colonized the land. That's false. That's a lie. The Jewish people, from the time we stepped into the land of Israel, well, Abraham was there, and Abraham's children, Isaac and Jacob, and then Jacob's children go to Egypt. We're in Egypt for 210 years. We come back, we in the desert for 40 years. From the moment we came back from the desert, the Jewish people were, the Jewish people have always been in the land. So it's more than 3,000 years that there have been Jews in the land of Israel. We lived in the land. We built the first temple. King Solomon, the son of King David, we built the second temple. We were there for 2,000 years. We are now exiled by the Romans in the year 70 of the Common Era after the destruction of the second temple. This is even before Islam exists, even before Islam is born. We've already been 2,000 years in the land. So to say that it's not our land and to say that we stole the land is a complete fabrication of history, and it's a very ignorant statement to make with a lack of knowledge of the real history of the land of Israel. From the exile of the Romans in the year 70 of the Common Era, so Jews have always been there, but there were Jewish communities that were exiled into different parts of the world. And so there was a large Jewish community in the diaspora and a smaller Jewish community in Israel, but there were always Jews in Israel. From the 1800s, so there were certain individuals that that pushed very hard for the Jewish people to return en masse to the land of Israel. And it's just an unbelievable story because there's no other story like it in the history of the world. There's no other nation that after being exiled twice, returned to its land and rebuilt its land. It's just a phenomenal story. And history really is the story of people. History is his story. It's a story of people, not so much the story of dates and events, but more the story of people. And people are complex creatures. People have greatness and have foolishness. People make errors and have achievements. And it's usually people that carry out the divine will. As the Gemara says, Harbe shluchim lemakom, that there are many different messengers of the creator of the universe, of Hashem. And it's important to see sometimes who the shluchim are, and usually they're not the ones that we would expect to be. You know, sometimes those that are doing the job are those that are not expected to do what they did. But it's just a fascinating story that Rabbi Wan highlights these eight individuals who made an invaluable contribution to the Jewish people returning to the land of Israel. So we're going to, I'm not sure how much time we'll have today to go through, but we'll start nonetheless the journey and try to get through these eight. And it's an amazing thing. It's like a puzzle. You've got a piece of a puzzle. If you look at the individual pieces, you can't work out what's going on. But when you put the pieces together, you see this magnificent picture. And it's a magnificent picture that Hashem painted, which is the story of the Jewish people returning to the land of Israel. So we'll start with the first one when we return after this break.
This is Focus on Our Sages with Rabbi Danny Sackstein on 101.9 Chai FM.
So to start our journey of the eight individuals who we met on the way home, the first of those eight is a very great person by the name of the Netziv. The Netziv is the acronym for Rabbi Naftali Tzvi Yehuda Berlin. He was born in 1816 in Lithuania, and he was the rabbi, the Rosh Yeshiva of the Yeshiva in Volozhin, which was at its peak throughout the 19th century. So it started in 1802, and it closed in 1892, which we'll discuss shortly. The Netziv was a very broad, a very brilliant, a very gifted individual. Rabbi Wein, who's the author of the book that we're basing the series on, his grandfather was a Talmud of the Netziv, was there. And so his accounts of Volozhin were firsthand, which is something very special. The Netziv, Rabbi Wein says that his grandfather used to say that his we have the Sfarim of the Netziv, Ha'emek Hadavar, his Chuvus, we have his Perush on Shas, but we don't have the Netziv himself. because the Netziv was so multifaceted and was such a broad person, he couldn't be put in a box. He was a very, very influential person, probably one of the most influential Jews in the world in the 19th century. And he was the head of a movement which focused on Jews returning to the land of Israel. That movement started with the Talmidim of the Gra, of the Vilna Gaon, and there was a trickle of probably between about 400 to 500 Jewish families that made the move back to Eretz Israel from Eastern Europe in the 19th century. And the Ottoman Turks were in control, was part of the Turkish Empire. The Turks had a massive empire, which included large parts of the Middle East, including the land of Israel. And this slow trickle, which also included some Hasidim from Poland, they settled in places like Sfas, Tiberia, but most of them went to the old city of Jerusalem. It's what we call the Yishuv Hayashan, the old Yishuv that made their way back to Israel in the 19th century. And these individuals were the first ones to build outside of the walls of the old city. They built Mea Sharim, that neighborhood. They built Nachal HaShiva. And it was very difficult for them to support themselves because there was very little economic opportunity or economy that was taking place at the time. And they were part, they made an organization which was called Chovevei Tzion. Chovevei Tzion means the lovers of Zion. And the head of this organization was the Netziv. He was really the figurehead of the organization. They had an executive director, a very famous Rav also, which we'll discuss shortly. But once the Netziv was the head of the organization, it gave it tremendous credibility in the Jewish world. And they raised a large amount of money throughout the Jewish community in the diaspora to support these Jews that were returning to the land of Israel. They had to smuggle the money in illegally because the Turkish didn't allow money. The Russian government didn't allow, the Turkish government didn't allow to send money into a Turkish territory from Russia. So there was always a shortage of money. There was never enough, which is, you know, common within the Jewish world. And nonetheless, these Jews that had returned were supported by this organization. And Netziv's oldest son, he was the Rav in Moscow, and he left his job in order to become the Rav in the old city of Jerusalem, Rav Chaim Berlin. When the Russian government closed the Volozhin Yeshiva in 1892, which was a great trauma for the Jewish people, which was of terrible consequences for Klal Yisrael, and there's a long story behind this, they saw the yeshiva as subversive, as a threat to the Tsar and his government, as undermining the rule of law in Russia. It's just unbelievable, the anti-Semitism. We see anti-Semitism is nothing new. It just takes different forms in different times. So they closed the Volozhin Yeshiva. Volozhin Yeshiva was the mother of all yeshivas, the beginning of all yeshivas. So when the Russian government shut it down in 1892, the Netziv wanted to join his son in Yerushalayim. And he took 12 of his Talmudim, they were not married, part of the yeshiva. Rabbi Wein's grandfather was one of those 12. And their plan was to go to Warsaw. From Warsaw, they would travel by ship to Odessa and then travel to Turkey. And once in Turkey, they would, through the railway, get to the borders of Palestine. And then by donkey, they would travel to the different cities that they wanted to go to. Unfortunately, the Netziv had a stroke in Warsaw in 1893, and he died in Warsaw. I've actually been to his grave in the Warsaw Cemetery. He's buried next to Rav Chaim Soloveitchik, who was his fellow Rosh Hashiva at Volozhin. Rav Chaim was married to the Netziv's granddaughter. But his Talmidim kept going. And Rabbi Wein's grandfather actually started yeshiva in Yafo, and where he was the Chavrus of Rav Kook. But nonetheless, the Netziv was the cornerstone. The Netziv was the figurehead who supported, who encouraged, who gave weight to this movement called the Chovevei Tzion. And therefore, he's the first of the eight individuals that we met on the way home. Please stay with us. We'll be back in a moment.
This is Focus on Our Sages with Rabbi Danny Sackstein on 101.9 Chai FM.
The second of the eight people we met on the way home is Baron Edmund de Rothschild. The Rothschilds were a famous family. The original patriarch was Anshul Meir Rothschild, and he had five sons, and he sent each one to a capital in Europe, and they started international banking. Up until that point, so if you lived in England, you couldn't bank in France because there was the channels of communication weren't open. They were at war most of the time. But since the Rothschilds had a brother in France, they would bank with their brother. And so that's how they built this massive financial empire. And the five brothers were sent to five major cities in Europe. One brother was in Naples, one was in Vienna, one was in Frankfurt, one in Paris, and one in London. In London was Nathan. He was an observant Jew, and so there was no business done on Shabbos. The brother in Frankfurt, William, also was an observant Jew. He was a big supporter of Shimshon Raphael Hirsch, and that's how Rav Hirsch did the amazing work he did. He needed somebody to back him. And that's always the case in the Jewish world. One needs financial backing in order to achieve things and to make a difference. And the brother in France was James. James was an assimilated Jew. Even though he was assimilated, he insisted that his children would not intermarry and they would not convert to Christianity, which was common at the time because it was important for social connections and business dealings to do so. But he was very particular about that. His grandson was Edmund Rothschild, and Edmund, already now third generation of assimilated French Jews, at 29 years old, he inherited the empire, the French division of the empire from his father and grandfather. He was worth billions of dollars at 29 years old, and he was not particularly motivated to be an international banker. Often we see that with families of fabulous wealth, that the children don't have the same drive and motivation in business, but they actually are motivated to change the world, to help the world, to improve the world. Sometimes it's out of guilt that they've inherited all of this money. And that's where we see all these great foundations, the Rockefeller Foundation, the Carnegie Foundation, the Ford Foundation, etc. So Baron Edmund de Rothschild is now looking for a cause. And in Poland, the executive director of the Chowowe Tzion, which is that organization which the Netziv, who was the first of the eight, was the head of, was a rabbi who was the rabbi in Bialystok. His name was Rav Shmuel Mualeva. And he had heard about the baron in France who was looking for causes to support in the Jewish world, worthy causes. And so he goes to see him. It's a very unlikely match. Rav Mualeva doesn't speak French. The baron doesn't speak Yiddish. Yet he goes to present his case, and somehow they communicate, and he convinces him that of this wild scheme, this wild idea to fund new settlements of Jews in the land of Israel that will work the land. And Rav Mualeva said, "You support these settlements, and we will give you the people from Eastern Europe." And the baron thought about it, and he was moved by the moment, and he put his full weight behind this cause. And he built 39 different new settlements in the land of Israel. Today, some of them are major cities like Rishon LeZion, Zichron Yaakov, Binyamina, Rehovot, Machzeres Batya. These are all places that the baron supported in the 19th century for Jews. In particular, after the 1880s, there were terrible pogroms in Eastern Europe, and Jews were looking to leave, and many took up this opportunity with the financial support of the baron and went to Eretz Yisrael. And so it was slipping just one more quick anecdote about it. He built a winery for the Jews in the north of Israel, and he called it Carmel Mizrahi. There was a Carmel, which means Carmel of the West. There was also a Carmel in the East, which was his wine company in France, but this was Carmel of the West. The first bottle of wine that was made by Carmel Mizrahi, which, by the way, he gave over to the workers, was sent to the Netziv in Volozhin. And the Rav Baruch Levi Epstein, who was the nephew of the Netziv, the famous author of the Torah Tumimah, so he says when the bottle arrived, the Netziv went to put on his Shabbos clothes in order to receive a bottle of wine that was made by Jews in Eretz Yisrael, that within this bottle, all the mitzvahs, tluyos baretz, all the mitzvahs that depend are required in the land of Israel, were fulfilled in this bottle of wine. So it's a holy bottle of wine. Such was the Netziv's reaction to receiving that bottle. So Baron Rothschild was the second person. He's buried in an estate overlooking the Mediterranean. He wrote in his, I think he died in 1923, he writes in his ethical will, he says, I thank the God of Israel for allowing me to be a part of the returning of the people of Israel to the land of Israel. And so he made a massive impact and was very influential in facilitating the return to the land of Israel. Thank you so much for listening and have a wonderful day.